Talk Live. This is Rabbi Moshe Mechaim. You're now on Talk Live on Masorah.org. Hope everyone is enjoying the day off. We try to use these days off to broadcast programs, brief segments, about 30 minutes, interactive live programming regarding the topics that are current and Shavuot holiday coming up. Appropriate now to understand what the main concepts are of Shavuot. As we stated in the email that went out, the question is whether or not a approach to life which is non-observant or of another religion is something which is justified. And in order to approach this, again, Shavuos is the holiday which commemorates the event at Sinai. And of course, we know that many Jews, many non-Jews will try to justify a non-observant life or a lifestyle of a different religion by denying Sinai, denying mass revelation at Sinai. And of course, the other religions do have their own claims. The question is, how do we determine which is accurate? So to cut right to the chase, what we have to do is to look at the events and to determine, based on the varying accounts from different religions or different theories within even Judaism itself, which is accurate. How do we determine what is true? And again, as we're just commencing the program now, we always ask for all of you that are joining us to please just type in audio okay at the bottom of your screen. That just confirms for us that you're picking up the audio stream okay. So if you are hearing the audio fine, just type in audio okay at the bottom of your screen. And we will have a point in the program where we'll pause, we'll have questions. And if there are any comments, we definitely invite you to share your thoughts and reactions to what we're discussing. So we do welcome everybody today. And I do want to just recognize Joseph and Alex Mexico. Good to see you, Alex, and a number of regulars that join us. And we do have a new player, so we have a lot of people that are listening to this based on the player and not actually in the chat room. So we have expanded our reach, where just with a desktop player, you'll be able to listen to the audio. Of course, to do the interaction live, that's necessary to have the actual chat. So let's go right to the discussion at hand. The question about whether this event, that Revelation at Sinai, is actually something which we corroborate, which is true, which is provable. Now, when we think about any event in history, I'll open this up as the first question to all of you, all of the listeners today. How do we prove any event in history is true? That's the first question, and this is something which all of us live by. We've never seen our doctors or dentists go to med school, yet we trust our lives, or at least our health, in their hands. We are convinced that they are doctors, we're convinced that they are dentists. We're convinced of world history. We read books that talk about events of Caesar being the emperor of Rome or the battles of Alexander the Great. Nobody alive today is that old that witnessed this firsthand. So our knowledge is secondhand knowledge. So again, the question we're going to open up now to everybody is, how do we determine with 100% accuracy that any historic event is true? And again, this is not a typical webcast or a radio program, because part of the program here is to have your thinking and your feedback, your analysis of the concepts, because this is not just a one-sided program. This is where we're learning. We're interested in understanding truth, and that means there has to be a give and take. There has to be positions that are presented, questions that are asked, and discussions back and forth. So again, the first question is, how do we determine that any event in history is true? And we'll pause just for a moment. This way you can type in your responses on screen and they could be read. And again, this program is recorded. It will be posted momentarily, usually within a half an hour. After the conclusion, we do post it on the audio section of the Misora website. Okay, so Sapi is suggesting that we need several witnesses with the same information. Okay, well, let's say, Sapi, that we have, in order to prove a historic event, you're suggesting that we have several witnesses with the same information. Well, what would you determine would be a sufficient number of witnesses? What would you say the sufficient number of witnesses would be in terms of proving an event? Would you say it's a handful, 5 people, 12 people? I mean, let's say we had a baseball game, and you had 70,000 people. It was a World Series. You had 70,000 people in the stadium, and you did not attend the game. So you came to the game after everybody was leaving the stadium, and let's say it was a series where they refer to it as a Subway Series, where you have, let's say, the Mets are playing against the Yankees. So the first person that you ask who leaves the stadium responds to you that the Mets were the winners. They were the victors. Now, would you say that based on that one person's testimony that you would accept that? Well, I don't think anybody would. I don't think that would be a safe approach. Not that there's anything at risk. But if you would ask 100 and then 1,000 and then all 70,000 people who won, do you think it's possible that they would all say the Yankees won if, in fact, the Mets won? All right, what do you say to that question? Would you say that if the Mets actually won and you asked 70,000 people, would they possibly all conspire that, in truth, it was the Yankees? Would they all lie? Would they all lie? So that's the first question that we're putting up. Is that a possibility in the world, in the realm of reason? Can you suggest that you would have masses, 70,000, 60,000 people would all lie? Is that a possibility, yes or no? What do you say? All right, so we put the question to you, to the listeners. Okay, Dent says that it's a, unless it was a conspiracy to misinform. So you're saying there is a possibility. And Sapia wants to say that maybe 2% of the total audience might. But you would agree, Sapia, that you would not get 100%? So we have a dispute here. Dent, on the one hand, says that you could get as long as they all want to conspire. And Sapia would agree that it's impossible to get everybody. You would maybe get 2%. Well, the question would be, what causes the phenomena of a lie? So a lie, a fabrication, if we're talking about an event and we're saying that there was a fabrication, we have to show that there is some motive. Now this, Rabbi Israel Chait had given a fantastic class. We do have it online here. It is an article called Torah from Sinai. I urge everybody to read that. Again, it is in connection with the holiday of Shavuos. And he explains how the events that we see recorded in the Torah, and we'll get to them shortly, are actually in order to prove. And the actual verse that God uses, and of course we will have to prove the Torah's veracity if we're going to use a verse from the Torah, unless we'd be accused from circular reasoning. But if we just could assume for a second that the verses are accurate, and that the book, the Torah, did spread unchanged throughout the Jewish nation and even the other nations, and it records the following verse in Exodus 19:9, and it says as follows. God says to Moses, "Behold, I'm going to come to you in thick cloud in order that the people should hear when I speak to you, and also they will believe you forever." Again, so God says to Moses, to Moshe Rabbeinu, that I'm going to come to you. And this again is Exodus 19:9. God says the whole reason why I'm going to create the revelation at Sinai, and I'm going to create my voice emanating from a thick cloud, is in order that the people will hear when I speak to you, and they will also believe in you forever. And again, this is an important fundamental. This is not something which just applies to Jews. These ideas are for any human being. And I had been in contact recently with a very intelligent woman. I don't want to give a name, but we're going back and forth, and she's not Jewish, but she was raised in a Catholic or a Christian background, and realized the fact that there were no real proofs to Christianity or to Catholicism. And she came in contact with me, and over the past month or two has lodged some very good questions. And one of them, which was recently over, it was just actually yesterday, was in terms of, we know that there are laws about what a non-Jew can learn in terms of Torah, that the Jew has to remain the exclusive authority on Torah in order that the Torah does not become diluted or transmitted through those that are not well enough informed and certainly don't have the Torah obligations, because a person who's not Jewish is no less than a person who's Jewish intelligently or philosophically. However, there's no obligation except for seven laws on a non-Jew. So if a non-Jew would take the role as being a Torah authority without the obligations to practice, he would be less equipped to deliver information, since he does not have that pressure of obligation to study for the sake of practice. So I explained to this woman that in terms of what you can learn are definitely the seven Noahide laws, of course. Secondly, anything which has to do with human perfection, and that would include knowledge of God, which this whole session today is about. So this is something which I want to make sure that everybody feels comfortable, Jew and non-Jew alike, that this area that we discuss in terms of having knowledge of God, which starts with the proof of his existence and what his will is for mankind, that must be something which every human being has. Additionally, a non-Jew that wants to accept more than the seven Noahide laws is free to do so. They are just not obligated to, but they will gain the same perfection as a Jew. There are maybe just a handful, maybe three or five commands that the non-Jew cannot keep, which have to do with blurring the lines between a Jew and non-Jew, meaning keeping the Sabbath or the holidays is something which would misrepresent the non-Jew as being just like the Jew. But it's not because it's a belittling of the non-Jew, of course. Our founder of Judaism, Abraham, I tell people all the time that Abraham was not Jewish. Adam and Eve were not Jewish. God did not create different types of religions. God, as a matter of fact, did not even give any religion for almost 2,500 years. The Torah was not given Shavuos, the holiday that we're celebrating this Thursday night. It did not occur until the year 2448. Okay, so that is an introduction. We now have to understand, how do we go back to our question. Our question is, how do we prove any event in history, and then how do we know that Sinai took place? Well, we give the example of the Subway Series of Mets playing the Yankees. And if we ask all 70,000 or 60,000 people who won, we know for a fact that they cannot all unanimously conspire to lie, because in order to lie, you need to have a motive. People do not do things without a motive. That is just the way we are programmed. That is the way we are designed, and it's impossible to do otherwise. So in terms of an event that has unanimous corroboration, we know for a fact that even though we did not see it with our own two eyes, we can have equal security in conviction that the event took place. Okay, is that clear to everybody? Again, since this is interactive, I want to make sure that before we move on to the next point, the initial points, which are the foundation of this discussion, are clear. So let me pause for a second and ask any of you if there are any questions on that premise. Is it something which you all agree that if we have a historical record that is unanimous, that the, and again, we're talking about a record of witnesses, all right? I'll distinguish unanimous belief in a second. But let's just pause to make sure all of you do have that point. You could just type OK at the bottom, just to confirm that the point is clear. Okay, Aurora. Nice to see you, Aurora. I hope that all is going well. We just pause for a second, make sure everybody else has that point. Again, the point is, do we all agree? Okay, Lee in New York, good to see you again, Lee. It's been a while. Dent has a point. Dent says as follows: what about unanimous agreement from a very distinct group, like a cult. It would not matter where the unanimous agreement came from, Dent. It would be the fact, the historical truth would be determined exclusively on the fact that there was a unanimous record. And there was a, again, and the second point has to be that what the people testify to is something within the range of human apprehension of a typical human being. I would not say that if you had masses of people that said we saw an atom split, that we would believe that, because that's something which is very difficult to witness. But in terms of the event at Sinai, which we'll get to a second, or a baseball game, is very simple to distinguish between the teams. They have different jerseys, so we can determine that the people were accurate in terms of their perception of who is one team and who is the other team. Okay, so that should be clear. Is that clear to everybody else? Okay, so Aurora has agreed, and Lee has agreed that that is something which is true. And you can just type an OK at the bottom of your screen just to confirm that you agree with that premise. And then we'll move on to the next point. And Sapi wants to say, OK, he does agree, but the record should be certified in some valid scientific way, not speculative proof. Well, a record that I'm talking about is if we have written record. That's as far as I am describing what a record will mean. Okay, Denth agrees. Ben Noach, okay. All right, so I think we have an agreement over here that if you have masses that agree to something, even if you did not witness the event, you would then agree that the event had to be true, because the element of fabrication just could not be present when you had masses in the tens of thousands. Even 1,000 or 2,000 people, I think, would be sufficient that they would not have a common motive to lie. That just does not exist in human nature. Okay. Now, once we show that there is no motive and we have masses, then we also have to make sure that we understand that the phenomena witnessed is something which is within the range of human apprehension. And that we also had present in the example that we gave of a baseball game. Everybody knows what the sport baseball is, and everybody knows the difference between jerseys, and they can tell one team from another. Okay. Now, this is exactly why we accept historical events as truth, for example, Caesar or Alexander the Great, even though nobody alive today has witnessed them, because we only have one account. Okay, we have one account. Let me just take a few questions I see here. Actually, just one question. MK in Toronto is asking, how far back can we trace a written record? I don't think it matters how far back. I think it matters, do we have a, if we date the record with carbon-14, is that what you're asking, MK? I think we have the litmus test for a record, a historical record being true, is the fact that it is the exclusive account. So, for example, we only have one account of who was the emperor of Rome in a certain year. Now, based on that, the widespread acceptance of certain exact dates and names of people, geographic locations, this tells us that this had to be the accurate story, because these events are well within the range of human apprehension. Had there been, and this is a very important point now, had there been a real truth to what happened in Rome, don't you think we would have at least had two stories? Meaning to say, if there was some fabrication as to a small group of people as to who the real emperor was, I mean, today we should at least have the fabricated attempt to revise history, but we'd also have the masses who passed down the true history. So the fact that there is absolute silence, mass silence, this is another concept. This is another point which you have to recognize. If there really was an event that took place, or a different emperor of Rome during that time, we would have the masses passing down to us the real emperor's name and the real dates and locations, so on. But the fact that there is complete silence as to any other alternative history of Rome, okay, then we have to conclude that this is the only story. We only have one account. It is unanimously accepted. That must be true. Okay, is that clear? Let me just pause for a second, make sure that point is clear. And now we'll apply it to Sinai, to the entire event that the Shavuos holiday is based on. Because when we talk about the event that we have in the Torah, so the first point, of course, is, well, how do we know the Torah is true? You're trying to prove an event from the book itself. And I've heard the arguments that people want to say, well, where is your external corroboration of the 10 plagues in Egypt? All you have is the Jews that are saying this. Well, that's not true. You have other religions as well that maintain the Old Testament, as they call it. Okay? So again, the unanimous story that is passed down, if it really did not take place, if there really was not an event of the 10 plagues in Sinai, so and there had to be some other real, there had to be a true history of the Jew, but that is not located anywhere. So the fact that a group of people, a large group of people, passed down a story, and they attest to the numbers as well, they say that there were 600,000 just men alone above 20, aside from children. It actually says that right in the verse. That is Exodus 12:37. So if you want to just jot that down, that's a very important source. And it's not the only time that the Torah mentions it. So in the actual circulated story of the Jews that left Egypt, which these Jews passed down as truth, they record a number of 600,000 men above 20 aside from children. So you have well over a million, and even the accurate estimation is about 2 million that the rabbis suggest, because there's also the women. So they passed down the story, and it reaches the world, and it reaches us today. Now, if the story was not true, do you think that people would have accepted it? I mean, the example I always give is if I would say to the news that I was on the George Washington Bridge at 5 p.m., rush hour, and I claimed that there was some sort of an alien spacecraft that descended and handed to me some tablets of some unique material and had some message written on it, and it was traffic was at a standstill, and there were 100,000 people on the George Washington Bridge, clear sunny day, no clouds, no obstructed vision, and I go to the news and I say this to them. So the first question they're going to ask me is, well, where is this this mass? Where are these other 100,000 people that you claim to have witnessed the same event? And since I cannot produce them, since I'm fabricating the story, there's no way that the news will report it, and there's no way that anybody who is intelligent, who is sane, will take my story as true. And the story will not succeed. It will not be remembered even a month from now, let alone a year, let alone 3,300 years later, as we have the story today of Sinai, which is 3,300 and about 18 years later after the event. But the only reason, the only explanation for the fact that we have the story is if it was passed down, it was transmitted by people at the inception of the story. Otherwise, it could not have reached us today. So you have to think about the example I gave you. So just like I cannot transmit a story successfully from today forward, 3,300 years, so too, the Jews or whoever fabricated the story back then would not have convinced a nation of people that this was their history if they really had a different history. All right, so this must be clear, that the only way you have a history of any people, it doesn't matter whether the Jews or the Romans, the only way the story is transmitted is if people agree to the fact. And if I approach them and I say that you saw something with your own eyes and I did not see it, there's no way that I'm going to tell my children otherwise. I will not replace what I know is true with some story that a guy named Moses is trying to get me to believe. I'll look at him as being a lunatic because he is trying to tell me that I witnessed something else in my life than I really did. And just like I will refuse to transmit a false history, every other person will refuse that. Okay, and Sapi is having asked a question on screen. Let me take a look. He says, people accepted many years later the evidence, for example, Qumran, are from 1,200 years after Exodus. Okay, I'm not sure what you're questioning over there, Sapi, if you want to clarify. Okay, I'm not really sure what the questions that you're asking, but again, just because we find a document, it does not mean what's on the document is true. A document alone is not the proof. What you have as part of the proof here is, again, it's not just the written Torah. It's the fact that you have millions of Jews that are transmitting the story. The activity of transmission is what we're discussing right now. And yes, the transmission is about something which is written down as well. But even without the written Torah, if we have an entire world, for example, if we've, if let's say the history of Rome was not written down, but it was transmitted verbally by millions of people, and they and millions of people today told us this, we would have to accept it equally as true. The document itself is just a means of remembering what the actual transmission is, but you don't need that. You can have the people transmit it verbally. And no, in terms of a story being rewritten, I disagree with that completely, Sapi. I don't think that we have any difference in terms of the story of Caesar today than where it took place. The dates are the same. I mean, even thousands of years have passed since Caesar, and we still know his name is the same. We still know the dates are the same. We still know the number of people. We know that the uprising against him, all the facts have not changed. And if you did have changes, so then the argument against you, Sapi, would be as follows. We would not have only one account of Caesar, but we'd have numerous, because then you'd have to have all the variations. Those would be passed down as well, unless you want to say that original story was replaced with a story later on, and the first story disappeared. Then the second story transformed into a third story, and at that point, the second story disappeared, but there's no explanation for that. So the that concept is not something which is tenable. Okay. So again, going back to Sinai, we have this is where our proof comes from. And this is now why we say that the event took place. Because you have the unanimous transmission, the details are the same, and the people would not have transmitted this story. And it wouldn't be a story that slowly grew, because then you'd have different variations of the story, if that was, as you're saying, Sapi. Okay, but we only have one version of the history of the Jews, just like we have one version of the history of Rome in that era. Okay. Now, just going back to the verse, it's always important, because the Torah, again, is not just simply words, not just facts, it's not giving us a history. It's written by God, and if you have an appreciation for the depth of wisdom that you see in the universe, from the smallest ant to the cosmos, to the heavens, then you know that there's a tremendous amount of wisdom that is behind its design. And the designer, the creator, is the same one that gave the Torah. Okay? Now, the Torah itself has to be studied. It's not something which is just for a person to pick up and to read. So we have to look at the verses. Now, going back to our verse, let's look at this very carefully. If you have a Torah in front of you, a Chumash, a Bible, it's Exodus 19, verse 9. And again, what it states is God's reason why he's going to create revelation at Sinai, and he says as follows. God says to Moshe, God said to Moses, "Behold, I will come to you in a thick cloud in order that the people should hear when I speak with you, and also they will believe in you forever." Now, what is God saying here? What do you think the message is of that verse? God says to Moses, "I'm going to come to you in thick clouds in order that the people will hear when I speak to you, and they will also believe in you forever." And again, this is referring to the whole event at Sinai. And just to reiterate, the event is a voice that the people heard emanating from a mountain on fire. And as we explained in the past, the reason why God created his revelation, the method of proof that there is a supernatural being that is not part of this world, how do we prove that? If there is intelligence that is emanating from fire, so fire is the one element in which a biological organism cannot survive. In any other element, earth or air or water, biological organisms exist. And a person might be well-grounded to claim that the voice that they heard was coming from some biological organism. However, if you hear a voice emanating from fire, you know for certain that that voice cannot be biological in origin. The voice is somehow supernatural. This is the reason why God created an event where a mountain was on fire, and a mountain was used because since there were millions of people at this event, it had to be seen from a bit of a distance. So an elevated platform is a good means. That's why when you have a speaker at a big rally, he's at a podium in order that people in the distance can see him. The mountain is the same concept. So God created this event where the mountain was on fire and the voice and intelligence was emanating from the fire. And the people themselves attested to the fact, and you'll read the words. I'm not going to go through all the verses now, but you'll read the verses in the Torah. And when Moses, at the end of his life, is recounting the whole story of Sinai, he reminds the people how you told me that you were afraid that you were going to die. The voice was so great, and you admitted that this was God's voice. So it wasn't something which they were being persuaded. It was something which they admitted to themselves, and Moses reminds them of what they said. So they were convinced, because God does not do a futile act. If God is going to intend on having a certain effect, and like he says, he is going to come to Moses to speak with him in order that the people will hear, and they will also believe in Moses forever. If God's intent is for that, then you can be sure that God knows how to fulfill those words. He knows how to make it true. So now we have an event where about 2 million people attested to the fact that something supernatural spoke to them, and you can call it God, you can call it what you want. But the fact is that they did attest to it, and they passed this down. Okay, and let me just take one question on screen. Are many of the Bible stories mythology, since much of the creation story appears to be inconsistent with science, as well as a lack of archaeological corroboration for there ever being a worldwide deluge, a flood? Well, to answer you, Hindrance G, no, the Bible stories are not mythology. And there is corroboration between Genesis and the theories of the Big Bang. And actually, there's a professor, Gerald Schroeder, who has a book to that name, Genesis and the Big Bang. I suggest that you get it, read through it. He explains a synthesis between the claims of Genesis and also scientific knowledge, and he shows how they completely corroborate each other. Okay. Now, getting back to Sinai, so now we have an event that the people testify to being as true. And this is passed down. And again, we are not using the text of the Torah as being a one-sided method of what people would claim to be and accuse us of being what they quote as circular reasoning. We're not trying to prove the book from the book. The proof is coming from the transmission of generations of people over the past 3,300 years. And the same way that a person would agree that Caesar and Alexander the Great existed, they then have to use that same method of proof. So if you have masses at an event, and we have one unanimous history recorded and passed down through time, and there is no other version of that history, and the history that's recorded is something which is within the realm of human apprehension, we must agree that this is the history. Otherwise, we would not be in receipt of that historical account today. Okay. And one note on screen. It's a little bit off tangent, but I'll address it because it's important. The note on screen is saying that Torah does not have to be in agreement with science, rather vice versa. Okay, I would retract. I would say yes, that, well, again, scientific knowledge is not going to be against Torah. It's from the same creator. Okay. So now we come to the conclusion that the event is true. Now, but keep in mind, there's a couple of reasons, maybe more than a couple, of why people argue this and why people who are non-observant have a problem with it. The number one reason is because history of Caesar and Alexander the Great does not obligate you in any type of change of lifestyle. So it's very easy for a person to say, I agree with the stories about Caesar and Alexander. I mean, what student in high school, when they're learning this area, ever said, no, I disagree, and even though all the history books say it, I'm disagreeing? The person would be laughed out of the class because they know if you have a unanimously accepted historical events recorded, it has to be that that is the true event, certainly when there's no alternative history. Now, I just want to stop on one tangent for a moment that you have to keep in mind. And we have to be clear thinkers. And there is a big distinction between accepting the masses who testify to an event and accepting the masses who claim a belief. All right, listen to that again carefully. There's a difference between a claim of an event and a claim of a belief. Can you tell me the difference? Let me pause for a second. So that'll be our next question right now. I'd like to open up the forum to all of you. Can you distinguish between the testimony that we have regarding historical events and the claims of beliefs of certain religions? Because in both cases, we may have equal numbers of people that say we believe that Jesus walked on water. We believe that Jesus healed the blind. Then you have people, same number of people, will say, we agree that Caesar existed. What is the difference in terms of the veracity of their content? Do you think they're the same? Are they different? And why? That is the question. The difference between masses of people who say that we believe in something Jesus said or something Muhammad said, that's one type of masses. And let's say, for argument's sake, you have 1 million people in both parties, all right, in both camps. One camp of people says, and there's 1 million of us, we all believe that Jesus walked on water. Then you have a group, and let's compare apples to apples here. And then you have 1 million Jews that say, we believe that there was revelation at Sinai. Now, why would we accept one and dismiss the other? Okay. Let me just pause for a second, and I'm going to read, starting with Lee. I'll read your comments on screen and see if we can get to the bottom. And again, everything has to be based on reason. Our entire life, we use reason in all areas. Religion is no different. Certainly, religion is more important because our lives here are temporary. If we're lucky, we live to 80 or 90 years old. But when you talk about our soul, something which can endure forever, that is something which we should take much more care about. So Lee is suggesting as follows. He says, an event actually happened, so there's something concrete to describe. Okay, Lee. Niora says, none of Jesus' miracles were ever written down by anyone, so where were the masses? Okay. Well, people did write them down, but maybe 100 years later, and that would be a problem. Why are they waiting 100 years to write down something? If there were 5,000 people that Jesus fed with some fish and a loaf of bread, why is there complete silence? Evidently, the silence shows you that there was no miracle, and it was fabricated later. Okay. Niora also writes that Jews are excellent record keepers. Why did they write down any of it down? Because it did not happen. So Niora also wants to add that the Jews who keep records are not biased about history, so they would have recorded any type of miracle that Jesus did. But we see that we do not have any type of miracles of Jesus. Okay? Ben Noach is writing, do you mean 1 million who were witnesses or 1 million who were not witnesses but accepted? Well, that's the distinction, Ben Noach. And Hindrance wants to say that a whole nation saw the revelation. Okay, right. So what you're saying, Ben Noach and Hindrance, are both, and Lee as well, I think you're alluding to that, Lee, is that the difference between 1 million people that claim a belief and 1 million people that claim to have an event transmitted to them, that is the very difference. To have 1 million people believe something does not require there to be any event. We can get 1 million people today to believe anything. All right, if there's some sort of an attraction, like for example, Hitler was able to get the Germans to believe they were an Aryan race. The belief appealed to something, but they did not believe that they saw anything. There was no belief. There was no conviction in an event. Hitler did not get the Germans to agree that they witnessed an event that did not take place. That would be impossible. Then they would know that Hitler was insane, but he used his insanity guided by a certain rational principle that he knew had to appeal. But that insane hatred was something which he had, and evidently many, many Germans had that same type of an emotional attraction. And he appealed to them with certain emotions in a similar way that a musician will appeal to the emotions of a person with his melodies. So he said things that sounded very appealing emotionally, and the Germans accepted it. But no way did he convince all those Germans that they witnessed something. Okay. So TL is writing a good point, that belief is harder to refute since it's somewhat of an opinion, while an event is more real, requiring a yes or a no answer. Agreed? And Sapi is saying as follows, the only problem that we have is that all the people that were witnessed died in the 40 years in Midbar Sinai. Okay, it's true. The people that witnessed the event of Revelation had died in Sinai. However, their children unanimously received the transmission of the event. And if the people in the desert did not see the event, and if Sinai did not take place, then the parents would not be able to tell the children something that took place which they knew otherwise, because the masses would have said what the real history was. Again, whenever you try to make a claim that there was an alternative history than what we really have, that you can't just create without having any type, some sort of record in hand today. But there are no records. There is nothing. There is a unanimous story that is only limited to Sinai, to the Exodus, to the Red Sea parting, to the 10 plagues. Okay. All right. Any questions at this point? Let me pause. We said quite a bit. Let's just pause, because what I want to go into now is what the reasons, which was the title of this session today, today's program was, is there any type of justification for non-observance or to accept another religion? So let me just pause. If you have any questions, please put them on screen. And again, I do want to welcome everybody today. I just remind you all that if you did join the class, actually the program, a little bit late, we do record this. It is placed online in our audio files. There's a link on the left-hand side of your screen, about seven or eight links down. This is audio. In there, you'll be able to click on today's recording of today's program if you missed any part of it. Okay, now one person, Sapi, is writing that faith is above reason. That is not true. Faith is something which does not require reason. If a person just believes and has faith in something, that's because he doesn't have proof of it, but he maybe sees enough about his friend's love that he has faith that his friend will continue to love him. He has no proof, though, that that love will be continued. So faith is something which is not grounded in actual proof. It's based on something, but it is not as strong as proof. Okay, and Carol in Montreal is making a point that God gave every human being a intelligence, gave a brain to every person in order that we utilize that. True, exactly, and that is something which is the thrust of what we're discussing today, that the Torah's prime message. When God says, again, going back to the verse 19:9 in Exodus, when God says to Moses, I'm going to create this revelation at Sinai, and I'm going to create it in order that the people will have a proof that I exist and that I spoke to you and that you are the prophet. And keep in mind, God never did this with any other religion. No other religion has any type of a record of a mass revelation, for the simple reason that there's only one human being. So God will only give one religion, because there is only one type of human being. All the other religions are basically human beings. We all stem from Adam and Eve, and these are just people that deviated and decided that they wanted to have statues instead of trying to relate to a more of an abstract God, because statues satisfy basic instincts, whereas they decided that route instead of maturing intelligently and realizing that whatever created the universe is not physical, and we have to accept that as a truth. So religions are man-made. But man, all man, it doesn't matter whether we're black or white or what we look like, we all stem from the same couple. So we all have the same exact design. Therefore, there could only be one best way in life. I mean, the doctor is going to treat a person who's Chinese with cancer the same way he's going to treat a person who's Negro with a cancer. The same way he's going to treat a person from Austria with cancer, because the human body is identical. Similarly, the human psyche and our soul, what we need for happiness, love of family, hatred of people that want to hurt us, these are all common because we are identical both physically and psychologically and philosophically. Therefore, only one religion makes sense. And a couple of points on screen. Do you know people who came to Emunah, meaning belief in Judaism, based on these proofs, or rather are these proofs material to assist those who already have faith? So Jay is asking an interesting question. Do I know anybody that came to Judaism based on proofs, or is proof secondary? Well, I'll give you one example, and that's me. I did not come to be observant based on any type of external reasons, or I should say external motives or emotional motives. I came to it based on these arguments. These arguments are what appealed to me as being proof solid proof, just like science and math. Once I saw these ideas that the Kuzari speaks about, Maimonides and all the great rabbis. But itself, every human being knows that history is based on, we prove history based on scientific knowledge. Religion also has to be something which is provable. And once you prove it, then you have an unshakable conviction in it. Faith is something which can come and go. And TL is asking a question. Can religion be solely based on reason? What if our reason is later found to be incorrect? Well, if your reason is found to be incorrect later, then you did not have a truth. But your question, is religion solely based on reason? Well, let's put it this way. A human being only knows something to be true based on reason. So if you're asking, how do I live my life? Should I live my life based on what I feel, or should I live my life based on what is true? I think you can answer that question. I think in every other area of your life, TL, you will base your decisions in life on reason. How you're going to select a school for your child, what job to go into. You're going to have a contract that you have to do a lot of work for. You are not going to just believe that the contract was written. You want proof of the contract. You want a signature. Well, in terms of monetary areas, that's one thing. But in terms of your own soul, that is something which I think is a little bit more important. And you should seek proof to know what is true. And God says to the people that you must, he says to mankind, know that I exist. We have intelligence. We have a faculty in us that can prove things beyond a shadow of a doubt. Take any area of your life that you know that you can prove, and there's basically your testament to the fact that you have a faculty. You have the capacity to prove something 100%. Now, if you have that, that means you have it for a reason. And you can't apply that to other areas. To abandon that when it comes to religion is basically succumbing to notions that other religions have spread, and which unfortunately a lot of Jews have adopted. Faith is a very heavy word. It carries with it lots of connotations. And it is very appealing to say, I'm going to just believe and look how great of a person I am that I could just have blind faith, because you hear that so much from the rest of the world. Well, I guarantee you, when it comes to a life or death situation, you will not have faith that somebody's a doctor. If he tells you to take a potion, you will want to make sure he's a doctor before you ingest anything. So that same desire to protect yourself physically in terms of using your intelligence and reason, use that when it comes to your soul, something which we can surpass and have an enduring life, even after we expire physically. Okay. Sapi wants to say religion is not based on reason. Well, I think I just showed you, Sapi, that that is not true. And if it is true, then you have to change your method in life, because if you're not living your life based on reason and you're just going on faith, then you have no disproof against Christianity or any other religion, Sapi. So you should follow it according to your reasoning. Any belief that you come up with is true. And what I would say to you, Sapi, is that if you think that religion is not based on reason, it's based on belief, and you're picking a certain religion, well, why should you follow yours if I have another religion and I say mine is based on faith? You'll have no means by which to say that you're correct. And if that's how you want to live your life, it's tragic, because then you're saying you'll live your life without any proof that you're living a correct life. Niora wants to say, if our reason is based on the Torah, then it is not incorrect. Okay, true. Further, God gave us Torah, so we should know what is real and what is not. Exactly. We have the ability to discern true and false. Every human being has that, and we should engage it. Ben Noach 73 writes as follows. This is jumping way ahead, but it appears that when choosing a path to follow, much of it rests on the wisdom and character of its teachers. That is to say, while one can comprehend some knowledge of the Creator on his own, actually knowing the will, the specific teaching of the Creator, comes from those who have the teaching. It's true, you may start that way, Ben Noach. You may first have to rely on transmission from a teacher. But as the rabbis say, and as your own mind will tell you, if they can have conviction, you can have it too, and you must. Rabbi, I'm trying to remember his name, Bachya, Ibn Pekuda, Rabbi Bachya, who wrote the book called Duties of the Heart, a very important book written about 1,000 years ago, or so, roughly, states in the beginning that if a person just listens to the rabbis or the teachers and does not use his own mind to prove those concepts to himself, then he's committing a grave error to himself. And that's against what God wants. And it's based on a Torah verse that says you should know it today, and then you should apply it to your heart. All right? That's something which we say in the Olenu prayer every day. You should know it today, and then you should apply it to your heart, that God is in the heavens above, and the earth below, there is no other. This is something which is a crucial lesson, that we don't just rely on what somebody tells us a concept, but we must confirm that to our own minds. That is something which we have to confirm. All right, in Deuteronomy, it's 4:9. So Moses tells the people, be careful very much for your souls, lest you forget the matters which your eyes saw. All right? He says further that you should commit this. You should know it, and then you should know it. You should know it today, and then you should place it in your heart. That means you first know it through transmission of others, and then you have to take what you heard and convince yourself in your mind. Okay, Ben Noach, very good. I see that you agree. Okay, TL is writing as follows. We find reason that we should be following the mitzvahs to begin with. Yes. And a question comes up from Hindrance. Can we find reason in all mitzvah? Do we have a reason for all the laws? Well, first of all, if God created all the laws, they must have reason, because the whole perfection, as Rashi says, of the mitzvos, of the commands, the perfection of the commands is not merely the physical performance, but it's the intelligent comprehension of what the perfection is. Okay, that is very important. It's a very, very important point that we don't just look at the mitzvot's actions as the be-all and end-all, but the concepts behind the mitzvot. And as a matter of fact, it says of King Solomon that he knew the reasons for all the laws except for one. So that means they are available to man. And the higher level of our learning and our practice and our intelligence, the greater amount of understanding we will have. Okay, in the Orah, the Orah writes that the book of Deuteronomy of Devarim is what showed her the truth, and also 2 years of Torah study. Okay, it's very good. It's great to hear that it has that impact. And again, reason. I mean, you'll hear a lot of people that, again, going back to that concept of faith, it sounds so appealing. But you have to divorce your emotions from what you know you can prove. And since we have the capacity for truth, and again, we've said that a number of times already, you should apply it. You must apply it. And that's something which God says. And that is why God says to Moses, I'm going to come to you and make this physical revelation in order that the human mind, the Jews there at Sinai, will have a proof of my existence and that they will believe in you forever. That means God is saying, I do not expect people just to believe things. That is a very important verse. Again, write that down. You test. Deuteronomy 19:9 is basically where God is showing that the method for a person's life has to be guided by reason. This is the core of today's program. The Torah's primary message is that you must lead a life of reason. You have intelligence, and this is what you will use to discern falsehoods and truths, whether it's coming from friends, people who are not Jewish that don't have the ideas, or even coming from a rabbi who does not have the truth. It does not matter the personality, the appellation, the reputation of an individual, the masses, the numbers of an individual cannot be what tells you whether or not an idea is true or not. It has to be whether it complies with reason. Okay? That's an important rule. Okay. And Benoach, you're writing as follows. There is a difference between something that cannot be comprehended and something which is contrary to logic, like a triune God. Yes, exactly. There are things which we cannot understand, which meaning what God is. We cannot understand because we only have five senses. And the same way I cannot understand what the person is thinking right now, because there is no sense that I have that can penetrate a person's mind. So also, there's no sense that I have that can perceive God, because God is not tangible. So that we can't understand. But we can know something contrary to logic, meaning to say that black cannot be white simultaneously, or that God is one and three at the same time. It's ridiculous. Okay. Now let's get to another point in the program, which is the final point of the program, and that is the are there any arguments? Now that we've shown that Sinai took place and that God gave one religion and no other religion has any claim and all of their claims are based on belief and there were no masses at any events and the religious just don't have it. And like I believe Niora said earlier, the stories about Jesus weren't written down until 100 or 200 years after the supposed facts. Meaning it's a very safe position that the Jesus' disciples took. They basically heard about him because they didn't live in the same time as he did. And they decide, oh, we're going to write down that 200 years ago, X, Y, and Z took place. Now, either you're going to believe it or not. I could do the same thing. And the only way I'll get people to agree with me if I tell them you must have blind faith. That's why it succeeded. Because your sins are completely forgiven. It gives you a guilt-free existence. There's many, many appealing factors. As a rabbi once explained, a very strong appeal to Christianity is the unconscious appeal of killing the father. Freud spoke about this, the Oedipus complex, where a young man, the first sexual object is his mother, and this is how he's relating to her when very young, and their aggression develops towards the father, and that can stay with a person. And an adult male that will hear about this concept that Jesus took God's place, basically Jesus killed God, that unconsciously appeals to that Oedipus complex that Freud had described. And besides that, there's many other appeals. Again, the fact that if a person hits you on the cheek, give him the other cheek. I mean, foolish things, but they sound nice. And we can go through them one at a time and see what the appeal is. But just because something is appealing does not mean that it was proven. But the religion spread because it appealed to people's emotions. And that's why it spread like wildfire. But not one other religion has any mass event where God gave a system. Judaism remains to be the only one. And the story we've shown is true. We do not have any other alternate story, and there is no alternate story. So this is important, and we have to keep on reminding ourselves of this because this is what gives us our conviction and gives us a new drive to understand, well, now I really know God exists and he has a plan for mankind. What is it? It's an exciting opportunity. The prospect of finding out what God really wants in my life, and that life, you know, is short. And instead of being focused on monetary and fame and what our culture feeds us in the media and every single sensation, let's use our intelligence and understand what exactly are the facts. The same way we prove science, you know, scientific truths and mathematical truths, let's prove what are metaphysical truths as well. Okay, let me pause again for a second and see if there are any questions at this point before we move on. Because now I would like to go and address, again, like I've said a couple of times already, we got a little sidetracked, but it's important that we're addressing all this. And the question is from Hindrance G. Was all of the written Torah given and recorded at Sinai? Yes, the Ten Commandments and the Torah, up to that point, is my understanding. There is a dispute on what exactly was given. You can research that. But certainly, from that point and forward, meaning from Exodus, you know, in the Parsha of Jethro, of Yisro, that was not made available, although God knew the future, but people have to have free will. So up to that point was recorded. But at the end of Moses' life, he gave 13 scrolls complete of the written Torah, from Genesis to some say where he died, and some say even the complete last six verses, I believe. Okay, and that's, I believe, at the end of the Parsha Mishpatim, if you want to look at Ibn Ezra and Rashi, you know, those great commentators where they discuss what exactly was given. Okay, but in terms of if you look at the Talmudic rabbis and the scholars that are the authorities on the Torah, there's no dispute that what we have is accurate. Okay, so we have to refer to the rabbis who were given license in the Torah to follow what they say. Okay, now, in terms of, what would you say now in terms of a person who wants to be non-observant? Do you, and let me address this to everybody now, do you feel that there's any justification for a person to be non-observant? or to follow another religion. What do you say? If you have a suggestion, if you're a possibility, type it at the bottom of your screen and hit send or the enter key. This way I'll be able to see what your response is. Again, the question is, based on what we've discussed so far, is there any justification for a person to be non-observant or to follow another reason, another religion? And if so, what would that justification be? And I'll just pause now and wait for you to put your answers on screen. And again, for those of you who are listening to this in the recorded form, because we do place this recording online, we do pause throughout the program since this is interactive, and we want the those who are visitors that are joining us today to have the opportunity to think about the problems, because Torah study is a give and take. It's not one-sided. So let me just pause a moment and wait for you to put your responses on screen. Okay, Niora wants to suggest it's the whole Torah or nothing. You cannot pick and choose your mitzvahs. Correct. Now, why would we say that? And again, the question is really, can a person just decide that, well, I have free will? A person could say, God gave me free will, and he wants me to choose whether or not to be observant. Is that true? Does God give us free will so we should choose whether we should be observant or not? What do you say? Okay, Ben Noach is writing as follows. Hypothetical, but you might follow another path. It was shown that not following it could bring great harm to your soul than not following the Torah, only if it is proven. That's why I say hypothetically. Okay, I would agree, but again, I would state that anything which is going to be good, God knows and included in his Torah. I mean, if a person finds something in the physical world that's not under the guidelines of Torah, a certain diet or certain clothing or whatever it may be, that will be good for the person, and again, good for the person in as much he's trying to live a life of wisdom, then the person should follow it. And it will not be contrary to the Torah. It's impossible that God would give a system for all mankind and state this is the best thing for you and then not include things which are mandatory for your happiness. And the Orah writes as follows. In my Chumash, a commentary states that the Torah is not a grab bag from which we may pick and choose. It is the blueprint of a complex edifice. Unless every part is followed, the building may collapse. Yes, exactly. Meaning if a person is leaving out anything from the Torah's commands, that means he's omitting something which is necessary for his happiness. So he's omitting something that is essential to his well-being as an intelligent being. So it ends up, let me just read Ben Noach. He writes, to harm your soul, he writes clarification, something to harm your soul as an eternal benefit or harm. Okay, understood, Benoch, right. If we find something which can help us, we should go for it. And if we find something which is going to harm us, of course, we should avoid it. But the bottom line is that the if you see people that are not observant, they have to be choosing that life based on an emotional justification or inconvenience, but not because they've studied the Torah. Had they studied the Torah, it would be just like studying biology, human biology, and seeing how the body works. If a person sees how the body works, he knows he should not put fluid in the lungs and that he should not put hard substances like rocks in his stomach. He would recognize that the body works a certain way and that by violating the rules of the body will cease to exist. If he chooses life, then he will be hurting his goal by going against the rules of the body. Similarly, if a person, everybody agrees that they want happiness, that is not something which is a debate on. And as such, since people do desire happiness, if they studied the Torah and they saw how each one of the laws contributed to their well-being, not just in themselves, but the society, and gave them ideas about truth, and actually that the entire process of study started to become something which replaced normal entertainments and enjoyments, and they started to see that asking questions and seeing answers and thinking into matters themselves started to expose a whole new lifestyle where they enjoyed study, they enjoyed how knowledge reveals itself on many levels as you go further and further. When a person would perceive that, they would put aside their physical pursuits, which are always dependent upon certain situations and conditions and can never really give the fantasized happiness that a person thinks about. You think about all the vacations you took that it was raining when you got there and the luggage was lost and you didn't get the right hotel and you tried to go somewhere but it was closed, or if you wanted to play tennis one day and the court wasn't open, or there weren't enough sessions available. The list goes on. You want to have a good meal, but then you eat too much and you get full, or you ate some bad food. Every one of the physical areas that a person goes after is always riddled with disappointment because a person does not know how to manage himself. However, if a person uses his intelligence, he can satisfy his physical needs, but then he also realizes a greater satisfaction in his life when he's using his soul, because the soul is something which a person feels empty when he's not feeding it. That's why people constantly run after physical pursuits, after fame and fortune and pleasure and the sexual and the appetitive, because they know they want happiness, and they only assume that this is what's going to deliver them happiness. However, if a person uses their intelligence, they will see that a greater happiness comes from understanding the position in life, knowledge, seeing a new idea. It can be a very thrilling thing for a person. Okay. Now, it would end up that the person who's not observant then is not following reason, is not following the examined life. Furthermore, there are other emotional distractions that I think it's important that we identify. Just to close, again, there is the appeal of other religions. And again, we talked about faith and different things that they say, and they sound emotionally pleasing until you analyze them. There's also the fact that there are masses of other religionists, and this sometimes sways our opinion, and our estimation will emotionally be based on what we see masses, because we are raised by parents. We have a sense of authority as we grow up, and even as we grow older and realize that we are just as capable as our parents, sometimes many people will not abandon the feeling that what the masses say must be true. And many Jews will as well. I've heard Jews say that, you know, Judaism is for Jews and Christianity is for Christians. I mean, they couldn't be further from the truth, because they haven't realized the falsehoods and the lies that are contained in that religion, and how it's so dangerous for a person to live in a way where he hurts himself and believes things that are not proven and are false. False notions about God. But since so many people say it, a person is still very infantile in their thinking, and they can't argue it with the masses. But this is one of the challenges in life, that we do have to become independent, think for ourselves, and be convinced by the proof of the concept itself, not on masses. It doesn't matter how many people we see doing something. It does not matter how many old churches there are with treasures of artifacts and religious items and paintings from the 14th century. All these things can play on a person's emotions and feel, wow, there's such a plethora of items out there that seem to substantiate the religion. Well, the religion must be true. No, that is not any proof. That's important that we identify what these emotional pulls are in order that we can use our minds to refute them as being any type of an attraction. Okay. And let's just pause one more second, take one more round of any questions right now. and then I'll just close off with just what the bottom line is, what we should come away with from today's program. So let me just pause 1 second, see if there are any questions that any of you have. Type them on screen, and I'll try to address them. I'll just pause for a second, see if there's any questions. If not, we'll just conclude. All right, so let me just wrap up the basic message here. Okay, Nior, I'm glad that you enjoy the site. I hope that you continue to gain from it. And again, everybody here should know that we do have, besides the online class, you know, the Talk Live program here that you're attending now, there is also a Jewish Times that you can subscribe to. If you look at the very top of your screen above the Masorah logo, just to the left of the Israeli flag, you will see subscribe free, and you can start receiving the Jewish Times every week. Hopefully that'll contribute to your Torah study. And we do record many of our readers' questions and answers in the letters section, so we hope that we share that with everybody else. That answers a lot of your questions too. So in conclusion, from God's words, again, in Exodus 19:9, God tells Moses that I'm going to create revelation at Sinai. I'm going to create this mountain on fire and cause intelligent words to emanate from the fire in order that human beings who function by reason and proof have a real proof for the existence of God and the one religion. God is acting in compliance with how he wants us to function. God is condoning the very creation of our intelligence by creating a proof, meaning something which appeals to our minds as a solid evidence, solid testimony, and not just for them, but for all generations, that he exists and that he gave Moses the mission to transmit the Torah by complying with what man needs for proof. God is saying, use your minds in all areas, especially in religion. Use your intelligence to decide. And by doing so, you uncover the world of truth. Because the way the world of wisdom is, it's an invisible world. We don't see it with our eyes. But if we study nature, we study science, and we study the Torah, then we will start penetrating the world of wisdom. And only with an attachment to truth will we be able to distinguish between what is false and what is true. And only then do we gain knowledge. If we do not have that ability to distinguish true and false, if we're not functioning on that and we're just following blind faith approach to life, you will not cover any knowledge. You will not gain. And as Maimonides says, since the objective of our life that God gave us is in order that we come to a love of God, that we come to a great appreciation and awe for the universe, for the wisdom that we see, he says that inasmuch as one learns, that's how much love of God he will have. If he learns little, he will have little love of God. If he learns a lot, then he will have great love of God. So it is my wish that everybody has that opportunity, and that we look at this holiday of Shavuos, which commemorates that event at Sinai. The primary message of Torah is what God performed at Sinai to create a proof, the way man's mind works, that God exists and that we should live by reason. This is the primary message. And if we avoid it, then we succumb to the emotions and the false arguments of those who are not observant and those of other religions that believe in blind faith and, oh, we got to just believe what the masses do and that must be true. Then we are forfeiting our one life that we have. Okay, so that's a very important lesson. So with that, I will close. I wish everybody a very happy Shavuos, that you should all enjoy the holiday. And those of you who are joining us today that are not Jewish, you're Noachide and you're studying, again, please join us and continue learning. And anything that we can do to encourage your greater participation, you write in, send in your letters, send in your questions. And that's what we try to do with the site, is to be a good sounding board, to do the research, to respond to matters that are very very much concern you, and to make sure that we're every step of the way we're getting closer to what is true and what is truly Judaism. I wish everybody a good Shavuos, a good week, and I'm glad that all of you are able to join us today on Talk Live at Masora.
Thank you.